Warning, the hosts of this program are not broadcast professionals. They have no idea what they're doing. They are bad at this. One of them uses swear words. A lot. All complaints about this show are correct. You have been warned. This is your last chance to download a real podcast. Okay, you asked for it. Here are Dave Brown and Iron Mike Irons. This is Entitled Town.
All right. Thank you, Al. Al doing another great announce. Al, I was afraid, I was worried that maybe Al would have trouble doing the announce through his mask. But Al is refusing to wear a mask. And I said, this is bizarre to me, Al, because when you would go out in the past, before all the pandemic happened, you would wear a mask. Al was just wearing a mask all the time. He was kind of like Michael Jackson or something. And now, only in that specific way, by the way, only in one sense was he like Michael Jackson. Second way, he has a very smooth voice. But that's it. There's only two ways that Al is like Michael Jackson. And neither of them, they're both, one's just weird and one is that he's talented. But anyway, I'm like, Al, you're just trying to be edgy. You didn't want to wear a mask before, or you did want to wear a mask before, but now you don't. I can't follow it. All I care about with Al, though, is that he gave us a great announce today. So what do you say? You want to celebrate Al's greatness right now?
Not on my agenda, Dave. How you doing otherwise? I don't want to talk. I'm not here to talk about the past. I'm here to talk about the future.
Iron Mike Irons is here. I set him up with a perfect opportunity to insult Al, and he did not take it. And I find that to be very commendable. We're all coming together. We're all going to beat this thing, whatever this thing is. Could be the virus. Could be anything. I don't know. We're going to beat something. That's what's important. We're all on the same team. We're all working together. We're all going to succeed. I think that's the message that we want to take to the public. And now let's talk about some things that happened in the media that we disagree with. All right. So now let's be divisive again. So we're in a trickle of news and of things happening in sports, but Tom Brady still gets to be the focal point of everything every week, because right before we went into lockdown, as we were locking down, the doors were being locked and closed, and Tom Brady was driving around Massachusetts telling everybody goodbye. Like, that's basically what happened. And then we all went into our homes, everybody except Tom, who has just been in, working out in parking lots in Tampa Bay for the last month and a half. While that's been happening, it's just been all Tom Brady news in the sports world. And the most recent comes via Gary Myers, who used to be with the New York Daily News. Is he with The Athletic now?
No, he's unemployed, I believe, Dave. He is no longer working for a viable or non-viable media entity.
And because he didn't write a story. He just posted on Twitter some information that he had. And to condense it, he basically said on Twitter that, in his opinion, here's why Brady left New England. And he says this is in no order of importance, but here are some bullet points. He was worn out by Belichick not having fun. He wanted to create competition with Belichick to see who could win a Super Bowl without the other. He was tired of Josh McDaniels. That is the key part of this story. But he also wanted more money and more than a one-year deal, which I don't even think that one doesn't make much sense to me, because I think Brady could have received those things in New England. Talent around him diminished again. I mean, I think the Patriots have a very talented roster, but if you're talking about specifically offensive talent, I think it's clear that they were starting to stockpile on the other side of the ball. So maybe. And then he had a warm weather. And I think everyone can agree that Tampa is warmer than New England. As to whether or not that mattered to Tom Brady, only Tom Brady can answer that. But the stuff about McDaniels was what really grabbed headlines. And it also drew an immediate response from Tom Brady. Who, what was it? Tom Brady.
It was an immediate and sharp rebuke about.
On Instagram.
You're wrong. Yeah, on Instagram, that saying that Gary Myers was in fact wrong. Please stop this nonsense. Please be more responsible with reporting.
Right. Right. And it went through like every headline that came out of this Gary Myers piece. Report, Tom Brady had deteriorating relationship with Josh McDaniels. And he tells him to be responsible. 19 years together and brothers for life is how he ends it. And, you know, Gary Myers goes on to say that he has, you know, a spectacular source and that he trusts the source. And okay. And
the
then
chest
today,
thumping, the chest thumping when it came to touting his source as unimpeachable really just it rubbed me particular the wrong way. All this was, Dave, this was Gary Myers using social media as a job application for anyone who will employ him.
So it also is one of those things where, you know, I would say people like you and Gary Myers create a problem. I don't know quite how to phrase this in terms of I can't put a title to it, but there's this phenomenon that happens where Gary Myers puts out that report, and then a fan like you will come and say, "Wait a minute, that doesn't add up. Tom Brady's saying the opposite." And then Myers digs in at this point. And that shouldn't happen. But he almost has to, because the credibility of his story will disappear if he says something like, "Listen, this is the information that I have, and that's what I'm going with." And there's almost this desire to be like, "I'm infallible, my source is great," and not acknowledge the truth, which is that maybe that's not 100%. Maybe that's how it was communicated to you, and maybe that's not the full story. And, you know, Myers says he has multiple sources, but if you're talking about Tom Brady, and I don't remember any point in the last 20 years Tom Brady responding to a story this way. And some people are saying, "Well, no, it's just because he just left the Patriots." But I don't know. I feel like if Tom Brady responds this strongly to your story being wrong, you have to acknowledge that you didn't talk to all the people that you're supposed to. But then there's this almost defensive element among reporters that they feel like they have to, because of the social media conversation, that they have to stand by the accuracy of something, even when that accuracy in a case like this clearly has to be in question. Myers has to acknowledge that there's some that it's possible that the person who told Myers this story might be misinterpreting things that actually happened. But that, you know, at the end of the day, Tom Brady could have had some kind of issue with McDaniels. That repaired itself. They went on, and they still have a great relationship. And that might not be a reason that he left. And so
there's something about Myers's reactions to his report on social media that reeked to me of Colonel Jessup on the stand. He just wanted to say who his source was really, really badly. He just wanted to have his mic drop moment, but you know, he knows he can't do that. You got to trust me.
Right. Right. And, you know, one thing, let's bring in sort of the Bedard angle on this, because I think that these two stories kind of meet in the middle. So again, we try not to talk about Greg, and we made it through like a whole 2 weeks of almost not talking about Greg. And then what happened today? He just slipped one in under the wire.
There is nobody covering the Patriots, and I'm including the mittens wearing dullard of and other people on sports radio of the world. There is nobody who is more loathsome, more of a disingenuous asshole than Greg Bedard.
All right, but that's not what happened today. Tell me what did Greg do today that wound up putting that we're now talking about him on this podcast? What did he do today?
Greg tweeted early Sunday morning, or should I say late Sunday morning, Eastern time. Quote, "What you won't hear from Team Brady is that Brady largely checked out in 2018 after the loss to Pittsburgh and hated how the offense pivoted to a more run-based attack. But that ended in the Super Bowl title, so you don't hear any public complaints about that season."
Which is, he then goes
are you shitting me?
To parse, like you, all right, so people like you responded.
Doesn't sound very respectful, Dave. People like me. What do you mean, you people?
I know. So I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you to jump on that. All right. So fans. So
the Pittsburgh loss dropped them to 9-5. Yeah. Back-to-back losses. After that, the lateral game in Miami, they lost by a point. Then they go to Pittsburgh and they only score 10 points in a place that they usually own, and they owned the Steelers for many years.
What do you think it means when you say that someone has checked out?
They're done with you. You know, they kind of brush their hands. They're done with you. They're done.
Right?
Like checked out.
When you hear that, checked out, you would think that Brady was like just tuned out the coaches and mailed in a performance for the rest of the season. Is that what happened in 2018 after the Pittsburgh game?
I don't know. I seriously don't know, Dave, how someone could actually tweet that as a promoting his story. It wasn't just a tweet. He pinned it to his Twitter account to promote his story on this, what I believe is a bullshit premise. They won their next five games after that. They scored 24 points, 38 points, 41 points, 37 points, and then 13 points against the Rams in the Super Bowl. Doesn't sound like a player who checked out on it. Now, the tweet that I actually find more damning, there's a couple of follow-up tweets on it.
Yeah, wait.
Bedard states that Brady checked out after regular season game number 14.
Yes.
They beat Buffalo at Foxborough. They destroy the Jets at Foxborough.
Run heavy game against Buffalo, but then almost kind of a rope-a-dope kind of thing. They came out against the – I remember this distinctly. They were so run heavy in the cold. It was bitterly cold against Buffalo. They barely threw. And it looked like early on as if they assessed the conditions. They assessed how the run game was working. And they really just decided to keep pounding Buffalo, and they won 24-12. The next week, they blew out the Jets, and it was almost like the Jets came, like, to stop the run, and they just – Brady just cut them up all day.
And I don't know how someone could look at the team that's been – McDaniels has been a part of for the better part of two decades. How you cannot look at that team. They're not a running team. They're not a passing team per se. They always have been, under Belichick and McDaniels, a game plan based team. There's not one. I mean, Brady is obviously the linchpin that makes it all go. That 2018 team was very good, and their defense was fantastic.
And Brady went on, then had an incredible game against the Chargers. You know, we know that there were a couple turnovers against Kansas City, but I mean, if you think he's checked out in that AFC Championship game, I don't know what to tell you.
It's a disingenuous premise at best, and just reckless at worst.
So, okay. So then people start putting this to him about how Brady played well in the playoffs, and Brady actually played well against the Jets. So after that Pittsburgh game, there were like four games there where Brady threw for 250 against the Jets on 33 attempts. He then threw 44 times against San Diego. Actually, it was the Los Angeles Chargers at that point. Threw 44 times, 343 yards with a 106 rating. That was a great game. Completed 77% of his passes. And then had the great game in Kansas City where statistically not one of his best, but, you know, we also overtime. And that threw for 348 yards in that game. And then
– Maybe those three consecutive third down conversions wouldn't have happened. He would have converted them on second down if he was checked in.
Right. And then threw 35 times in the Super Bowl against a great defense. And, you know, obviously that was not one of his best games. But I'm not even going to entertain the idea that Tom Brady was checked out during the Super Bowl. I'm not going to. That's completely absurd. So people raise these issues with Greg. And what was – do you remember Greg's response on the playoffs?
Well, people rightfully pointed out the point we just made, that he had a really, really good playoffs. That game – we've talked often about that Kansas City playoff game. That's one of the great playoff games in the history of football. And his reaction after Burkhead scored the winning touchdown in overtime, to me, you know, it's kind of the image I think of when he jumps into Hightower and Van Noy's arm. Yeah, he doesn't look really checked out to me. the Rams were a worthy opponent in that Super Bowl. As bad as their offense was in that game, with a lot of help from the Patriots defense in the game plan, the Rams defense is that good. They struggled. They won. Mm-hmm. And it's the lasting effect of that game that they lost in Pittsburgh was after that game, Belichick and McDaniels have both said this on Do Your Job 3, is that they couldn't win, you know, wanting to throw the ball and score 35 points a game. Now, ironically, they did score a lot of points for most games for the rest of the season, but they did, in fact, become a run-heavy team.
But do you remember what Greg said when so this was nice. So Jared Haybon, who I don't know who that is.
He's a blue check mark, and he's evidently on The Bachelorette.
He's on The Bachelor. Amazing. Amazing. So you know why Greg responds here. It's because of a check mark, right? So this guy from The Bachelor, who I've never heard of, I don't know who he is, he writes, I read the article, and I'm a big fan of yours. However,
it's indictment number one.
By the way, this is the exact correct way to get Greg to respond to you. Have a blue check mark and say, I am a big fan of yours. However, if you ply Greg with flattery, you can get a long way. You can get him to respond. He'll hide in the bushes if you're mean to him and you're from a burner account. But if you are or any like anonymous person, like he won't deal with any kind of anonymity unless you're nice to him. But if you're mean and anonymous, you're not going to get a reply. But if you're flattering Greg, he's all there for it. So Jared.
Or if you give him your credit card information.
Jared Haybon, of Bachelorette 11, Bachelor in Paradise 2 and 3. He says, I read the article, big fan of yours. However, not sure how you could conclude Brady, quote, largely checked out in 2018, threw for 343, and had a 106 rating against the Chargers, threw for 348 in KC, including the 3 3rd and 10s he converted in OT. And Greg responded with, I didn't say the playoffs. Okay.
There's always a qualifier with this guy. Always a qualifier.
Is your premise that he checked out for the last 2 weeks in December, which included that game against the Jets? And then you drew my attention to another response from Greg. Do you have that?
The other response triggered me greatly. I have it here if I want me to read it.
Please.
This is Greg's third, the third tweet that has me triggered today. Quote, checked out has nothing to do with gameplay. There are 7 days in a week and only one game day. There's more in the story. That was a snippet. Hold on. That is the dictionary definition of clickbait. He pinned this tweet to his Twitter account ostensibly to promote his work and his website. It's a bullshit premise that he's claiming he checked out for two regular season games and then checked back in for the playoffs, the season in which they won the Super Bowl? Really? Does it pass the sniff test, Dave, or am I crazy?
You're not crazy. I mean,
well, in this case, I'm not crazy.
This is yet another example of a situation where Greg uses words in a context where we all agree that that has a certain meaning. When you say an athlete checked out, you know, you're not talking about 3 days in December of 2018 when you say checked out. Like, checked out's like done for the day. When you go to the library and a book is checked out, it's gone, right? The idea is that Brady had just written off the season, and clearly that is not what happened. Clearly. So Greg decides after the fact, when he's criticized, that his use of a term that we all have an agreed upon meaning for was not actually the real meaning of what he said. He's gonna dial it back to some very specific meaning that could only be understood if he tells you about it later. So Greg's poor communication gets him in trouble, and then he blames the audience for not understanding him. Every time people
a person who allegedly makes a living communicating poorly and then blaming the consumer for it.
So do you want my okay, so we got this Meyer situation and we got this Bedard situation. Do you want my speculative take on what's going on here.
Of course.
Okay. So there is some information. I will call this raw intelligence that is floating around out there. Okay. Because so Chris Gasper is also involved in this. He essentially backed up the Myers report. But Gasper says Gary's dead on here. The professional personal relationship between Brady and McDaniels was more strained than publicly portrayed, a source told me. Brady found it frustrating that Josh wouldn't install plays, TB12, he calls him TB12, wanted in the game plan last season. It felt like a phasing out. So I will say this, that there is some rumblings floating around that back this up. And I haven't verified them. Like, I haven't cross-checked them, but now I've got Myers, I've got Chris, and I've heard this from elsewhere, that it wasn't so much that Brady and McDaniels had this horrible falling out that led to Brady checking out for the season or led to Brady deciding to leave, but that there was at one point some issues between Brady and McDaniels in terms of Brady wanted things to go one way and the coaches decided that they should go a different way, and that maybe Brady felt like his input had less value than he wanted it to have. Okay. Again, now I don't know if that's true, but I think that that's Bedard and Myers framing the exact same story in two different ways. One with the extreme, hey, these two had a terrible relationship and that's why Tom left. And the other saying, oh, Tom was upset that they chose this running direction and so he checked out for the season. I think both of those are extreme, perhaps even source-influenced takes on what actually happened. And then one of the things I find amazing is in Gasper's confirmation, He says, Gary is dead on here, and then describes something that is slightly different. It's not dead on. Chris's version is probably the closest to what I've actually heard, which is that the relationship was, quote, more strained than publicly portrayed. Okay? Which is to say, there was no real strain publicly portrayed other than 2017 when Brady yelled at McDaniels on the sideline. After overthrowing a pass in Buffalo, the play that Seth Wickersham wrote about, which is like, I mean, we may as well be at Entitled Town Bingo here. You know, we've got Seth Wickersham involved, but anyway, it was portrayed that they were friends, and now Brady is sticking to that story. I think it's true. I think they are still friends, based on what Brady's telling us. But it does sound like, like in any professional relationship, that there were disagreements at times. Did it have the seismic effect of knocking Tom out of Foxborough? I don't know. I mean, I think everything that we've seen so far suggests that that decision was bigger than any one factor. Gary Myers acknowledged that. And I think part of what happened here is that Myers, I didn't get the sense that he necessarily set out to make this about Brady and McDaniels. I think that a lot of headlines went with that angle and prioritized it over the other information. And so again, and we talk about this a lot, but we're in the environment where headlines are the commodity. People who aggregate pick up the most headline worthy piece of information and then perhaps generate a story that isn't headline worthy. So perhaps back in the day, we used to have what were called notebooks, and you would write like little blurbs about pieces of information that came along. And so this might only be like notebook worthy material, something that you wouldn't write a headline around. But then when headlines became the inventory, those little notebook items where you'd write like 1,000 words on 8 different topics and you just break up in little pieces, suddenly each of those eight things became eight new stories. Now you're writing them as if they're all headline worthy. And I think that's where we're at with this Brady McDaniels thing, is that rather than give an accurate picture of their relationship, we're putting a headline out there because Gary Myers said that, and therefore you can turn it into a headline. And anything that can be done in journalism now is done. If you can,
Tom Curran did it for the entire 2018 and 2019 seasons. He built this new brand of his on Brady rancor with the organization for two solid seasons. And why is Chris Gasper tweeting about this instead of writing a story on it? It's not Dave. Well, it's not an item in a notebook comp.
Because he's in TV now.
Yeah. Allegedly.
He's at Channel 5. He's Channel 5's Chris Gasper now.
If he's on Channel 5 and nobody watches it, does it really exist?
I don't know. Probably. I mean.
Allegedly.
I think this is the environment we're in now, where look how much information we have, and I feel dumber than when we started.
Yeah, it's the wheel of morons. It's the same tired stuff being rehashed and written and spun in different ways over and over and over again. And it's one empirical truth that's proving true time and again, is that Brady equals clicks. That's all. And Myers got the attention that he wanted, and maybe he'll get a job interview out of it. Bedard gets, continues to look like a fool and, continues to piss away any credibility he may have had at one time. And Chris Gasper is irrelevant. So it's the same as it ever was.
Well, I also think it's telling that when you look at the Brady Instagram post where he defends his relationship with McDaniels, Gary Myers' name appears once as he's cited to in Michael David Smith's story from Pro Football Talk. So you have sort of a
Hannibal-esque aggregation. That's all that is.
Right. It's the aggregation that produced the headline report. Tom Brady had, quote, deteriorating relationship with Josh McDaniels. That was not a headline from Gary Myers.
You have to have a job in media to get a headline.
True. Now, maybe it would have been. But isn't it interesting how the aggregation becomes this game of telephone, where something that was in that list of bullet points from Myers,
it's a good way to put it, a game of telephone.
Yeah. And I'm not sure where Myers actually started with his tweets, but hard to present an order of why Tom Brady didn't want to return to Patriots. One thing has been very much overlooked, according to an excellent source, his deteriorating relationship with OC Josh McDaniels. You know what? Myers did frame it that way. He did start at the top. So Tom was worn out by Josh after all these years. That surprised me. Well, maybe it surprised you because it's not entirely true.
Did come out of left field.
Like, you can have an excellent source. That's not correct. That's wrong.
What happened? I guess the standard for writing a story, and you'd have to have a gig to write a media story on this. It's single sourcing again. And you don't have, there's no backup. It's single sourcing. It's one point of view that could be misconstrued.
He claimed that somewhere that he had multiple sources.
Did he also claim he had multiple sources when Myers said that Bill Belichick was going to go chase his dream job of the Giants again?
I don't know.
Spoiler, he didn't.
Right. That was pretty suspect. But then he wasn't telling us that came from an excellent source, was he?
What's the phrase that pays? Culling. It's certainly true in Bedard's case. In Myers, consider the source, consider his history with the organization.
One of the things that I think, sometimes people ask us, like, well, why is it so important to get into the details here and parse these things out and question whether a story is accurate? And I think one of the best examples is the next thing that we're going to talk about, which we touched on. We went through the whole argument last week of why we didn't think that Bill Parcells should be in the Patriots Hall of Fame. And congratulations, Richard Seymour, who did get inducted, well-deserving. I mean, other than Brady, maybe the best player in that first run of three championships.
He'll be in Canton.
He should be at some point. You know, Ty Law and Seymour, just complete, you know, generational type players at their positions. And, you know,
he was Super Bowl 36 has been on TV, broadcast TV and cable TV recently. And he was a dominant force in that game. Their front four was particularly good in that game. Seymour was a dominant presence as a rookie in that game.
And we go, okay, so then in the days leading up, so since our last episode and the results of the election coming out, or the results of the vote coming out, we saw a lot of push from people like Bob Ryan, a really curious column from Steve Buckley of The Athletic, where they're still reciting things from 25 years ago that simply are not true. We've gone through it already with this idea that, like, you know, Parcells changed the culture and he had this massive effect on the dynasty somehow, despite the three intervening years of Pete Carroll, despite poaching Curtis Martin, despite a grievance to try to keep Belichick from coming here, despite the fact that the tickets did not, you know, exorbitantly shoot up when they signed him. And this absurd idea that, like, a football team only becomes good because somebody was coaching here 8 years ago. You know, it's almost like, should Jim Fossil be in the Giants Hall of Fame because of the Giants winning in 07 and 11 with Coughlin? Like, did Jim Fossil somehow start that? And that sounds absurd, but people had been getting that story about Parcells for wrong for such a long time that now when I talk about it on social media, people don't even believe me that these things aren't true. They don't even know who Bobby Greer is. Bobby Greer being the general manager who drafted all the so-called groceries that Parcells was upset he didn't get to pick, causing Parcells to leave. But people will say things like, Parcells drafted Bruschi and Lawyer Malloy. No, that was Bobby Greer. And for 25 years, those things get locked in people's memories. And now we're talking about, well, let's give Parcells a red jacket, even though they can only put in one person a year, and the other two people on the list both won three titles here. Vrabel and Seymour both won three championships here, and they were big parts of those teams that did it. There is no argument that Parcells deserves induction more than those two. And so Buckley's column about this is completely insane. His premise was that Kraft is still sticking it to Parcells. That Kraft is still sticking it to Parcells because he won't override the fan vote and put Bill Parcells in the Patriots Hall of Fame.
Absurd.
That he, like, owes this to who? I don't know. I guess to the media, because, you know, guys like Mark Farinella, guys like Bob Ryan from 25 years ago who are in the room with Bill Parcells, he charmed their pants off.
That is the point here, Dave. I have here, per Patriots.com, this is the Patriots Hall, which is, at its core, let's be clear, it's a tourist attraction. And these guys, they're building, you know, shrines to the tuna, these tuna toadies, for what ultimately is a tourist attraction. But here are the names that are on there. Ron Borges, Bill Burt, Curran's in there, Jim Donaldson, Mark Farinella, Glenn Farley, Ron Hobson's on there. Going on further on down the list, Chris Price was there, Butch Stearns, Andre Tippett, among others. So those, they gained their relevance in large part due to the popularity of Bill Parcells with the media at the time.
And so here's what they see. They see that Bill Parcells created interest in their work. Bill Parcells created interest in the Patriots. Yes, he did. But did it have some kind of contribution that lasted beyond his tenure? Nope. Did he do some things that soured the taste of his tenure in the mouth of some fans? Yes. And so I think when the fans are telling you via vote that they prefer somebody else, I think you listen to that. And what, you know, Bill Parcells, I don't remember who he's talking about. Maybe you do. When he said, this is what he does to you guys. He sucks you in. You got sucked. Do you recall the quote?
I don't. I thought you were going to talk about he's a ball in tall grass. That Parcells filled. Parcells did one thing that at an elite level with the Patriots, and that was fill notebooks. Provide material for the 6 p.m. news. That's all it was.
And he I'll
made
tell you
their
what.
Jobs easier, and this is now they're stumping on his behalf. But it's more than that. For me, it's more than that in this particular case with Ryan and with Buckley. They get off on wagging their fingers at the great unwashed, the fans, and need to tell them what they should think. That's certainly what it is in Ryan's case, and I'm confident that's what it is in Buckley's case. They love to pontificate.
Right, and you know, there was this Ringer article a few years ago about Dan Shaughnessy. Like they did a profile on Shaughnessy, and he says something pretty repugnant in it that the article sort of celebrates. It's bizarre, but he says, I was never really like, and I'm paraphrasing here, so pardon me if I get the quote wrong, but that basically his rooting interest was in himself. That what he was rooting for were outcomes that would drive interest in his work. And that's exactly what's going on here. Bill Parcells filled notebooks. Pete Carroll would stick around. Like, apparently Parcells was tough during the week, and then on Fridays would just sit there and talk forever. Pete Carroll was like an open book, right? And then when I started covering the Patriots in 06, I didn't understand how much, like, I'd go into this room and half the room just hated him. And you sit there and you go, yeah, but of course he's tight-lipped. He's trying to win football games. And he is successful at that. Now, I remember in college we had this football coach named Floyd Keith at the University of Rhode Island. And there was a point where he was playing almost like a Tom Brady, Drew Henson kind of thing, like changing the quarterbacks and using him at different points. And I asked him the question in the press conference, you know, what criteria are you using to decide which quarterback is going to play when? And he said, coach's criteria. And that's pretty much exactly what Belichick would say. I'm going to do what's best for the team when he's my criteria. But the key difference between Belichick and Keith Floyd is that Keith Floyd, his team stunk. And so maybe we deserved a little more explanation into his reasoning, like help us understand what you're doing. So maybe we can be a little less critical of it, because right now we're seeing no results. With Belichick, it was like, okay, do you need to know more? Do you need to know more than going 12-4 with that 2016? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I saw somebody killing Jerry Thornton today on Twitter for being too much of a fanboy. And it was like, okay, you know, what do you want Jerry to do? Do you want him to kill them for the 13 times they didn't win a championship in the last 20 years, you know, or last 19 seasons or whatever it is? Like, they're winning championships in an unprecedented way. And
when they don't win, they're still very good.
And what are you supposed to criticize here? And that's why this podcast is called Entitled Town, because you can't appreciate what you have. But when I got there in 06, it was like, where is all this bitterness from? And the answer became very clear to me as I talked to some people who I was friendly with and who didn't really hate Bill Belichick. And it was because they had come out of an era where you had Parcells and Carroll, who were like the faucet of information. Now, it was the information they wanted you to have, but they filled the notebooks. And then Bill came in and turned off the faucet and suddenly starts telling players, you know, and I don't know that he told the players this, but this is what I've been told, is that players were told, you know, don't give out your numbers to reporters. Let's not be so cozy with the people who disperse information. And they hated that. And it's like, okay, you have the right to want the information. If you're a reporter, you absolutely have the right to do everything in your power. You have the right to go ask the player to contact you outside the stadium. You have the right to ask Bill Belichick, you know, a tough question in a press conference. You have all of the, but he doesn't have to play along with you. He's not obligated to do that. His job is to win football games. He has done that job better than anybody else in his field for the last two decades.
And so if you look at it from that vein, go ahead. I'm sorry to cut you off.
That's all right. You as a reporter, you have to figure out a different way. You don't get to sit there and be upset because your story isn't as interesting as you want it to be. You have to game plan for him the same way he game plans for you.
That's an excellent way of putting it. There's also the added element. Not only did Belichick come in the year 2000 and shut off the spigot, as you put it, is it the previous regime, the Carroll in Greer regime, there was an old joke about Bobby Greer had a back stairway up into his office so he could, you know, listen to the players, and the players had free reign to, I mean, Parcells had an old line when he was coaching the Giants about, he called the media commies. They were subversive from within, I believe was his exact quote. And that's exactly what happened. That team fell apart because Ron Borges bullied Carroll at a press conference after the Patriots got whacked at home by the Falcons in the 97 or 98 season, or maybe the 98 or 99 season. Bledsoe was chirping to his sources in the media. Carroll was chirping to his sources in the media. Bruce Armstrong was chirping to his sources in the media. And everything stopped. The flow of information stopped when Belichick came in the year 2000. And the media resented it, and they can't kill him on the results. God forbid, had Belichick gone 32-32 in his first four seasons with the Patriots after shutting off the spigot, gone. The torches and the pitchforks are out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You said so much there. But remember in our first episode, we talked with Matt Chatham. And, you know, he talked about how both sides of that information control issue, about how if you're out there just talking about something like, yeah, you know, like we really got our eye on this guy and we really got to stop him from doing whatever, then they're going to know that the other team's going to be able to glean some things about your game plan and what you think the important element is in stopping the other team. And then how he saw his own, when he played with the Jets, he saw how his own words were converted into bulletin board material. And I remember, okay, so he had this whole thing about how, you know, this was in the 06 playoffs, I believe. And he said something like, and apologies, Matt, if I don't quote you correctly, but it was along the lines of, you know, it's going to be a lot worse for them if they don't win this. Like, there's a lot more expectations in that locker room than there are in this locker room. And it eventually came around to a very small nugget of what could be considered bulletin board material. And I'll tell you what, I was really impressed going back and finding the story from 2006 about how the New York papers printed the entire quote. And it's a long one. In context, and I read it and I was like, if I was on the Patriots and I read this quote, I would totally understand what he's trying to say. They had to make it into bulletin board material. They had to go and carve out the like one little part that sounded like an insult and then blow it up and pass that around the locker room to tell everybody that their old teammate was taking shots at them. Okay. But that's what the other teams will do. They'll find that one slip that you made, and they'll convert it into bulletin board material. Or they'll find the one slip that you made and glean something about your game plan. And there's more to it than that. When Bill Belichick is standing up at that podium, he knows everybody on his team is going to hear it. He knows everybody on the other team is going to hear it. And he uses that platform to set the tone for how his team is supposed to communicate with the media, to say things about players that he wants his team to hear, and to set the tone for how they should speak to the media.
1,000% correct. That's what a leader does. He's leading by example.
Did I say three different things there?
Almost certainly. I stopped listening.
Or did I say the first thing twice? I can't remember. But the point is that, you know,
it's called augmenting your point. You're not repeating yourself. You're simply augmenting your point.
When Bill says things to the media, that is as much of a tool. It has as much to do with winning as some of the other things that they do during the week. And it's important. Now, it's not the most important thing, but it has to be done correctly, because releasing information that sends the wrong message to his locker room or inadvertently shares information with the other locker room can both be detrimental to the short and long-term health of your team.
The only time I can think of Belichick just absolutely eviscerating a player, do you know who I'm talking about, the incidents?
Absolutely eviscerating a player?
Eviscerating an opposing player. It was after the game. It was after Super Bowl 39.
Freddie Mitchell.
We were glad when he was on the field.
Yeah, he wrecked Freddie Mitchell. And you know that happens because, well, you know, I've seen him do it one other time. I want to say it was Anthony Smith.
Oh, after the 07 and guarantee game, the Steelers were going to go into Foxborough and win that game. And I'll tell you the one thing. I have no sources and no way to believe this. I believe Belichick went after Freddie Mitchell because his players were mouthing off in the locker room what an absolute jerk off that guy was. Freddie Mitchell caught one pass on the infamous 4th and 26 that the Eagles converted in the early 2000s playoff, and that's the only thing of consequence he did in the NFL.
Right, and it's
gonna piss off the greatest coach in the history of the sport.
When you're that disrespectful, you know, like. When you're that disrespectful and then they show it on the field, then Belichick is not going to be shy about telling you that. I can't think of too many examples where, like, most of the time when Belichick talks about opposing players, he is more likely to give you the best argument for that player.
The Lou Holtz treatment. He builds them up into Hall of Famers.
I don't even really bet. Builds him up with the Hall of Famers, but I think he's sending the right message to his team that, like, you have to take this person seriously. And then when the player is bad, it's more like, hey, this guy is terrible, and he's been disrespecting us for a solid week. So guess what we're going to do on Sunday? We're going to make him back up what he's been saying, and let's see if he can do it. Anthony Smith, we're going to throw a double pass directly over you to Jabbar Gaffney. And, you know, you're going to show up on a poster somewhere. Like, that's how they'll handle that.
I remember thinking when Brady threw that pass, the double pass you're talking to, Brady went down, or Nance's call of it was that he said, and Gaffney catch it for the touchdown right over Anthony Smith. And I'm guessing that Brady, in their pregame meeting, had some choice words to Sims and Nance about Anthony Smith and his loose lips.
For sure. And, you know, did you say that Brady talked about Smith?
I'm going to guess in Brady's pregame sit-down with Nance and Sims that he had some unkind words for Anthony Smith. And the two-pronged effect of not giving the other team bulletin board material, that Belichick, the policy he employs, is just that. You're not giving the other team bulletin board material. Conversely, as you mentioned, your guy's going to be ready to run through a goddamn wall to take it out on the field rather than, you know, bitching at each other using sports writers.
Well, do you remember what happened when Plaxico Burress, Garrett, like, he predicted a final score for Super Bowl 42?
I do.
And do you remember how Brady responded to that?
Brady said, we're only going to score 14 points or something to that nature.
Brady said something along the lines of, I can't blame him for being confident in his team. I just think, you know, if you're going to pick the Giants, could you at least give us some more points? Like, you know, why are you holding us back? I think we can do better than that. And that is basically saying, you know what? Plaxico Burress is a pretty good player. It's, you know, I don't agree with him, but I don't disrespect him. And
good player, not so good a marksman.
No, but Plaxico is the rare example of a receiver making all the difference. These like top flight receivers, you know, like Randy Moss that year, also huge difference maker. But this idea that you need to go and get an elite receiver, it doesn't necessarily add up to me. But with the type of quarterback that Eli Manning was, read, not the most accurate passer, to have a guy like Plax who had this enormous wingspan and could just go get anything, he was like a couple notches down from Moss in that regard, but could just, the contested catches, you know, he's like 8 feet tall and just could go get the ball. To me, he made a major difference for a team with a quarterback like Brady.
If N'Keal Harry turns out to be Plaxico Burress, Patriots fans would be pretty happy.
If they had won
between that game, the lines,
if the Patriots had won that game and scored a ton of points, and afterwards Tom wouldn't have been sitting there and Bill wouldn't have been sitting there talking about how terrible Plaxico was. They would have been sitting there saying, "See, I told you, I thought we could score more points, right?" Like that would have been the tone. But anyway,
something along those lines, for
something
sure.
Along those lines, right? But right. You know.
I like to discuss Super Bowl 42 that much.
Well, and now I've talked enough about Burris that I'm thinking about 2008 and how 2008 was such a really, we could have seen those two teams in the Super Bowl again. And with the injuries, the key injuries on those two teams, with Brady having the knee injury and Burris actually shooting himself in the foot, yeah, that's a bummer. So, all right, well. I have an idea. Do you want to hear it?
I'd love to hear it.
So something we've talked about, I think a little bit on the show and a good amount off the show, is focusing on something like the Seth Wickersham cheating article from 2015, the Wickersham and Vannata article from ESPN. And so I think we should do our next episode entirely about that, given that we're in a valley of information here.
There's always something as it comes up weekly. This morning, the Bedard stuff. Earlier this week, the Gary Myers stuff that provided us fodder to yak at each other for an hour.
But I think one of my hesitations in doing an episode on something as specific as just that one topic, my holdup has been, you know, like, are we going to be able to continue to talk about things that happen between now and then? And I think we should make a plan that in 2 weeks we should come back and we should record an episode entirely about that piece, because so many people point to it as the smoking gun of Patriots cheating. And it's a very empty, very misunderstood in a lot of ways story.
It's the gospel according to mediates. That's everything that's cited.
It very much is like separating framing from information. And there are two ways to look at that story, and I think it's worth us getting into it. And so why don't we promise to do that? Because I think if we promise to do that, then we'll probably do it.
Done.
Okay. All right. Anything else, like any emails?
We have an email from entitled Towner Mike Rabb, who wanted to thank you for uploading the same episode twice last week. He got through about 20 minutes before he realized it. But he appreciates that we're doing the show and tells us to keep up the good work. Thanks for the email, Mike.
I'm glad that our content holds up that well.
Unique, original.
So we are still at, let's see, what's today? Today is, so this must have slid in since our last episode. Okay. The hubris of Bill Parcells. And this is from our friend Ned Snark on May 5th. Like everyone, I had high hopes when Bill Parcells came to New England. Like everyone else, I should have realized his best days were long past. As the Pats, Jets, Cowboys, Browns, and Dolphins learned to their sorrow. 5 stars. Was Parcells involved with the Browns at some point?
I have no idea. I don't think so. Certainly not in any meaningful capacity. He may have helped with a coaching search, perhaps. But that I don't know.
Ned Snark is going to have to tell us. So we still hold a 5.0 rating. Ought to be possible 5.
It's a no-off day for us.
So I would ask you all to go rate us. It helps people find us, and it does great things for our ego. So, you know, for God's sake, we can't praise ourselves past a certain point. It means nice. We praise each other. Sometimes Al says nice things, but really it's when you guys, we're sort of like Tinkerbell from Peter Pan. If you believe in us, then we get power from that. And we stop pirates or something. I don't know.
That analogy makes me very uncomfortable.
You're right. You are accurate to be uncomfortable. That was a bad analogy. All right. Is there anything else going on?
Well, the Last Dance is on tonight. It's basically all I'm watching. I watched a little bit of golf today, so I'm looking forward to wrapping up the Last Dance so I don't have to listen to the Last Dance wrap-up shows on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday after that.
That Last Dance thing is like, I mean, it's kind of perfect for the world we're in right now because it's nice to have 2 hours that just takes you to another time and place. And, you know, it hasn't been so great for telling us things we didn't already know. I did love when Michael was playing quarters, or that quarter game with the
Hall of Fame mullet.
I mean, that haircut, I mean, that guy's amazing. But just that he's out there and they have some time to kill and they're playing this game with the quarters that has, you know, Michael gets 2 tries or 3 tries to beat the guy. And I don't know how they determine how many tries he gets, but they bet on it. And it's this whole like I've never seen this game before. I don't know if they just invented it among themselves, but I kind of love that. And the scene where they're at the All-Star game in the locker room, and it's Jordan's last All-Star game with the Bulls. And Larry Bird is the coach, and just Bird's like Jordan's attitude before the game when he's thinking about Kobe already, and he's like basically deciding like I just need to just destroy Kobe. Like that's my purpose today. And Bird, when he goes, well, we came all the way here, so we might as well win it. Like that's his whole coaching strategy for the game is we're here, so we probably should go ahead and win. I enjoyed that. But you know, a lot of it's, I wonder if in a different time I would enjoy the show as much. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. It's a lot of it's nostalgia. I mean, Jordan's obviously probably the greatest player in the history of the game. It's kind of cool seeing some of the inside stuff, the behind the scenes stuff. They had the camera, the NBA entertainment cameras with the team, the entire 97-98 season. It's good for the world we're in. It's like the golf tournament today. You know, I watched, you know, quite a bit of it. I think the hoopla for it is certainly because of the world we're living in currently.
ESPN, hype machine, you know. But yeah, I mean, look, Jordan, you know, there's Jordan, there's Brady, and then there's Jeter. And I mean, of the team, you know, and then I'd even put Rivera over Jeter. But like of the team sports, top of the heap guys, yeah, I mean, it's just that. That very narrow class of individuals who were that accomplished. And
it'll be interesting to see because Parcells on the brain. Belichick's love of NFL films and documenting history has been well stated. And the Last Dance equivalent of the Patriots, the when that chapter is going to be written, I hope it's written by somebody with the perspective and the talent to give it, to do it justice. That'll be,
I'm busy.
I said, well, I'm going to leave the low hanging fruit alone, but it's going to be, if they did something like they did in the 2009 season, when the Bill allowed the cameras in for that season, you get the unblemished honesty when they were getting pounded in New Orleans that year, him talking to Brady on the sidelines saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says, I can't get these guys to do the play how they need to play.
Yep.
And you juxtapose that with what we talked about earlier, the 2018 season, they were able, or he and his staff were able to get the team how they needed to play in order to win. And that's why I have a very hard time believing that Brady, whose singular obsession is winning, would not sign on for that.
And one thing, so when you talk about the concept of a Patriots version of The Last Dance, one thing that has struck me in watching this is how honest the players and the coaches and the executives were with the media in 1998. And
Jerry Krause tripping on his own dick at every stage, trying to undermine himself. It's Krause ludicrous. And that's what Jerry Krause did is exactly why Bill Belichick doesn't open his mouth and give, you know, what's the line from The Departed? Feds and media, feed him shit and keep him in the dark.
Right. Well, the whole way that they're honest, I look at it, and so I've mentioned this before on the show, but I recently read Playing for Keeps, which is David Halberstam's book that is basically it's like Jordan didn't participate in the book, but it tells the exact same story. It's the story of the 98 season, and it goes back in almost the exact same sequence to the earlier seasons, and it kind of jumps back and forth in the timeline, almost exactly the same as The Last Dance. And one of the observations Halberstam made was how access had dwindled in those 20 years and how little value the press conferences had. And I think that one of the things that I've taken away is it's become way less valuable, okay? Like, we're getting way less information from the players and the coaches and the executives. And I think it's because the media did a bad job back then. Instead of handling that information the right way and being responsible with it, you'd see things like where people would say to Jerry Krause in a press conference, you know, with all the backstabbing going on around here, does this or that concern you? And when you frame a question that way, it's really accusatory. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And it's not a fair way to ask a question. And so then you get to a point where you're like, why am I giving the media all this information if they're just going to cast it in the most negative, most salacious and the least fair way every time? Because I'm being fair with them. I'm telling them exactly what's going on. I'm telling them that Phil Jackson's not coming back next year. Or if I'm Scottie Pippen, I'm telling them that the team hasn't really made me happy. But who does that help? It helps the media. It doesn't help Scottie Pippen. It doesn't help Jerry Krause. So now what you see is information is quietly dispersed behind the scenes in ways that help the individuals who are giving out the information.
I never think it's very difficult to figure out roughly who a source is when it is, a private source. It's how the information is framed, that sort of thing. You can usually draw inferences who it might be. It's hard for me to believe, and I saw it with my own eyes. I didn't remember this. Jerry Krause sat at a podium and admitted he had been shopping Scottie Pippen.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that happening? That's not to happening. Such a dysfunctional organization. Pippen was, the fact that they won six titles with all that dysfunction around Daly is
Pippen,
more than anything, it's testament to how good Jordan was.
Pippen said he would never play for the Bulls again. And that did.
Yeah, he signed that long, long, long term deal where he was severely underpaid in terms of
his peers. It was towards the end of that deal where he was like, you know, he couldn't get them to renegotiate, and he said, I'm not going to play for them anymore. And could you imagine the Patriots? Could you imagine that happening? Like, could you imagine Brady coming out and saying, I'm not going to play for the Patriots anymore during the season?
Last year, and this was what I found to be out of character, you mentioned earlier Brady, what he said about, you know, the amount of points they'd score in Super Bowl 42. There was a quote that's kind of stuck in my craw a little bit. It was during the Patriots at Ravens game where the Ravens pulled away late and won that game big. Brady told Michaels and Collinsworth in their pregame sit down that he was the quote unhappiest 8-0 quarterback in the league. And that just, I mean, they were 8-1 after that game and they finished 12-4. Just out of character for Brady at that time. And I wonder, it made me wonder like how much stuff went on behind the scenes that didn't blow up into a, you know, a tempest in a teapot because the organizational philosophy was to feed them shit and keep them in the dark.
Yeah. Well, you know, but I think that I feel as if this is a situation where getting, you know, people are always getting upset. They're getting less information in these public forums. And it's our fault. It's like the media did it. We didn't handle the information properly. And I mean, you know, you live and learn, and maybe people said things they regretted, and no matter how the media handled it, there was no right way. But I don't know. I think you have to deal with people in good faith. And, you know, I think one thing I'm learning from that documentary from The Last Dance is that we weren't always dealing with the Bulls in good faith. And I'm using a very royal we there because I was still in college when this was happening. I was not even, I probably hadn't even been to Chicago at that point, but anyway.
Do you think somebody like Ron Borges has dealt with Bill Belichick in good faith over the last 20 years?
No.
Of course not.
No, absolutely not.
And I could go on a longer rant about this. Is once Bledsoe got benched and didn't get his job back, his words, not mine. Mm-hmm. He went behind. It got awfully personal between Borges and Belichick after that. Borges made the comment that if they were in school together, that Borges would have all of Belichick's quarters, so on and so forth, and been slandering Belichick for the greater part of 2 decades.
Belichick strikes me as the kind of guy in school where if you were taking quarters from him, it was part of an elaborate scheme to distract you so he could take, like, your bank account. You know what I mean?
There's arrogance and hubris being demonstrated there, and it's not being demonstrated by the coach of the Patriots.
I'm going to give up this part of the field, and I'm going to take this other part of the field that's more valuable. Like, that's, you know, and Borges seems to me the kind of player that's going to fall, the kind of person that's going to fall for the quarters being, you know, the thing he thinks he wants.
Ron Borges' journalistic practices, he's fallen for basically the pull my finger trick journalistically. So pardon me if I shame on the Patriots on having him in their Hall of Fame committee, and shame on the NFL as a whole, the NFL Hall of Fame, for allowing him to present Patriots candidates for induction.
It's completely wild.
It is unreal, but that's another subject for another time.
Well, I would say that, you know what? It's part of the erosion of standards as our entire society. And, like, we just let things go now. And it's wild. It's just, hey, you know, if we – sure, maybe people in this industry like Ron Borges. And maybe they have, personal good reasons to. But, you know, you got to – some things have to be bigger than that.
Hey, John Tomasi, would you like to be elevated to a columnist with NBC Sports Boston? Hey, Ron Borges, sure, you were disgraced at the Globe, but come on over the Herald and continue to peddle your agenda-ridden bullshit.
And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to get political here, but I'm not going to get too political here, but it's like, have you noticed that every time there's an election that both of the people who are at the top of the tickets or like every time there's an election, you look at both people and you go, each one of these people has done something so terrible that I would not hire them. You know what I mean? It's like, but then their parties completely overlook it. And we're just stuck with just the worst options every time because we don't enforce these just very basic standards. It drives me nuts.
On one side, we have pestilence. On the other side, we have the plague. Yes, you choose.
Yes. And it's like, I don't even care. Like, you have an idea about what we should do with taxes, and you have an idea about what we should do with taxes, and they're different, but I don't want either of you people in my life for 4 years. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want you to be my governor. I don't want you to be my mayor. I don't want you to be my president. And it's like on both sides.
Who are two people I wouldn't allow in my kitchen?
Yes. Yes.
I think we're quickly becoming grumpy old men, Brown.
Oh, this is the grumpiest, oldest podcast we've done.
What are we on to? We're on to tapioca.
Fair enough. I had said in the past, and we talked about The Last Dance, I had said in the past we should recommend television shows for people. I've thought about that carefully. The TV shows I'm recommending, I'm going to guess a lot of people who listen to the show, I'm just going to remind you to go out. If you haven't watched Banshee, you have to. Have you ever seen Banshee?
I haven't.
You should watch Banshee.
What service is it on?
I don't know what it's on now. It's got to be out there somewhere. Banshee was a show that originally, like, for a while, Cinemax decided they were going to get serious about making TV shows. And they made the show Banshee. That was awesome. It was about this dude who gets out of prison, and he's just a total badass, and he becomes his identity is mistaken, like he's the sheriff of this town. And he's not really the sheriff, but everybody thinks he is. And all he does is just kick everyone's ass and drink bourbon. Okay? And it's just a great show. Like, it's just
that's what Ron Borges sees when he looks in the mirror.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
it's on Amazon Prime, by the way.
And he's like, there's like Pennsylvania Dutch involved for some reason, but Banshee is the name of this town that he goes and lives in and becomes the sheriff of. And it's just, it's not too complicated. It's not melodramatic. It's just about a sheriff in this town who's actually a criminal, but he's enforcing the law and he's just kicking ass. Like, it is just a great show. Okay. And then one that I think people who listen to us, if you haven't discovered Brockmire, do you know what Brockmire is?
I do.
Brock, have you watched it?
I have, yes.
I mean, I think there are observations that he makes in conversation just as asides that I'm like, oh, that is the premise of our podcast. Like, there are so many times when he just completely nails aspects of what's wrong with sports media. It's about, the show is about a baseball announcer who is trying to come back after a very public scandal and a very public meltdown on the air. And so he's just getting back into minor league baseball now. And it's almost like somebody who, like Marv Albert, who had a very public controversy and disappeared for a while and then came back to do NBA games. And that's kind of who Brockmire is, but he's played by Hank Azaria. He's running commentary on sports and media. And the show, like, even uses Joe Buckwell, which is amazing. Like, it's the best thing Joe Buck has ever done somehow. So, and it's racy, and it's very, it's filthy. And so if you're not into that, don't watch it. But it is just, there are a lot of jokes about Derek Jeter-style gift baskets and all the shenanigans that Brockmire gets up to. But I just watched the finale, and it was very well done. And the show even manages to predict, with the show, which came out in April, okay, the final season came out in April, even managed to predict the pandemic. Okay, so go ahead, jump into that one if you haven't yet. Brockmire, Banshee. Do you have any television that you could recommend to people?
I started in order rewatching The Sopranos. I know it's edgy. It's a really deep pull there.
Yeah.
The writing obviously is just going back, even knowing, you know, the character arcs.
It holds up.
And that sort of thing. Season 4 is a little bit soap opera-y for me, but yeah, it definitely holds up.
I think you mentioned Janice to me recently. And
I did, yeah.
And your reaction to Janice was exactly how I felt when I first discovered Janice while watching the show. I was like,
oh, Janice and Livia are just reprehensible characters.
And Janice is so, that role is so, like, she nails it so just spot on of making Janice terrible that I...
Yeah, it's Janice. It's almost like Janice is going from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to the Boston Globe and then off to Sports Illustrated and then starting off on her own adventure with Bobby Bacala.
But it's like you don't want to watch it. Like, you,
it's painful to watch.
Yes.
Which was why, you know, the acting's so good. Livia, I think Janice is actually worse than Livia. She's such a reptile hopping from opportunistic situation to opportunistic situation.
You watch that show and you're like, oh no. Like,
It's cringeworthy.
A Janice could easily enter my life at any time. Like, and I hope that doesn't happen.
But. A Janice enters your life every time you go in the media room at Foxborough, Dave.
Whoa, that is harsh. I'm not saying it's inaccurate.
Harsh, but fair.
Could be fair. Could be fair. All right. Well, I think that we've done a podcast here. I think we've rambled on and on about television and.
This is a pinball episode. We're all over the place, bouncing back and forth.
We got a little political, where I basically tried to say that everyone's terrible, and I think that skirts the line in just the right, appropriate way. So, what do you think?
I think we're on to the appropriately named Seth Wickersham hit piece the next time we reconvene.
All right, we're on to Wickersham. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Bye for now.